from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, even justices are worried about what happens when the Supreme Court is seen as partisan.
We don't have an army and we don't have any money. And the only way we get people to do what we say that they should do is because people respect us and respect our fairness.
Also today, Elizabeth Warren's opponent says she should drop out of the Senate race if she wants to run for president.
If she gets elected and then starts running for president, that's at least one or two more years of nobody working down in Washington to have a seat at the table at a time when we need a voice in Washington to help us in Massachusetts.
And rediscovering Christopher Columbus and the advanced civilization he stumbled into.
It's not so surprising to me that we don't know the history. The history is often rather inconvenient. Columbus, as a progenitor of the United States, is sort of embarrassing.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. After all the divisiveness and turmoil, Brett Kavanaugh is a Supreme Court justice, having been approved by the Senate and sworn into office over the weekend. Welcome to the Kavanaugh era of the Supreme Court, where five conservative justices are poised to outvote their four more liberal colleagues in a way that threatens to turn a venerable American institution into yet another arena for partisan brawling. Or at least, that's the fear. Justice Elena Kagan spoke on Friday at Princeton University and reflected on this new Supreme Court, one without a true center.
There has been a person who found the center where people couldn't predict in that sort of way, and that's enabled the court to look as though it was not owned by one side or another, and was indeed impartial and neutral and fair.
Kagan says the court has to be cognizant of how it will now be perceived.
All of us need to be aware of that, every single one of us, and to realize how precious the court's legitimacy is. You know, we don't have an army and we don't have any money, and the only way we get people to do what we say that they should do is because people respect us and respect our fairness.
So, can this court stand above the political fray and maintain its legitimacy? Or will it fall prey to the partisanship that's splintering this country? Joining me now is Rosanna Cavallaro. She's a professor of law at Suffolk University. Hello, Rosanna.
Good afternoon.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Garrett Epps. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Hello, Garrett.
Hey, Evan. How are you?
I'm doing great. Garrett, I'll start with you because you wrote a piece over the weekend where you talked about how your sense of the court's legitimacy was shaped by your experience growing up in the segregated South and watching the Supreme Court force communities to accept integration. Why start there? Why does your sense of the legitimacy start there?
Well, I start there. That is, as a very young boy, I think it was an unusual time to grow up. I became aware of the Supreme Court. I became aware that the people around me were very critical of the court. They thought that the justices were wrong. You know, I remember as a boy seeing the billboards that said impeach Earl Warren and so forth. And yet I also knew, growing up in a relatively small southern town, I knew the federal judges who were enforcing or trying to enforce Brown versus Board of Education and the other desegregation opinions. And I saw the way that people in the community finally, history and the prestige of the court and just the sense of national unity forced people to fall into line, to say, well, this isn't what we would have chosen, but the court has spoken, and we're going to try our best to make it work. That was a formative experience for me. To me, a federal judge was sort of the the next best thing to being God. And, you know, the Supreme Court today has not got that place in our national life. And if a crisis like desegregation comes along, I don't think it will have those reserves of prestige to draw on.
So that really is, I mean, that's what makes that moment so powerful, because it speaks to the legitimacy of the court, why the court needs this legitimacy to enforce its rulings, and at that time, another time of turmoil. So Rosanna, if the court's legitimacy depends on Americans viewing it as a body driven by legal reasoning as opposed to partisanship, how can they enforce controversial rulings like they did 50 years ago? How can they go forward in difficult times and gain consensus?
Well, I think that's what people are concerned about right now. And I think that the dynamic, the truth of the matter is that the vast majority of these kinds of issues are about consensus buy-in, that citizens do accept these things as norms and accept the power of the court. And I think we still have a ways to go until we lose that completely. But what we don't want to see is that it's eroded at the margins, is that there's a skepticism that kind of aggregates or accumulates to a place where there really is a doubt about legitimacy. I mean, I don't think we're going to have a difficulty having whatever rulings are coming down in this next term be questioned in that way. I hope we're not. But the fact that people are continually talking about legitimacy is itself a threat to legitimacy.
And that's a good segue, because listeners, we want to hear you talk about legitimacy. Do you have faith in the Supreme Court? Are you worried about a crisis of legitimacy in the court? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Garrett, who's to blame here? Is this a plague of both your houses moment where the parties have conspired to undermine the legitimacy of the courts, or do you see it differently?
I think, I'm supposed to sit here and say, oh, both left and right are to blame. You know, we wring our hands. But I really can't. I think that the project of the Republican Party has been for more than 25 years to gain control of the court. And the last 2 years have been the worst possible exemplars of that strategy, beginning with the decision to refuse to allow a president to make an appointment to the court. And moving forward to the nomination and confirmation of Justice Kavanaugh, which involved the most not simply bare knuckle partisan operations within the legislature, but eventually a kind of terrorizing of the populace, where you have the president standing in front of screaming crowds, who are yelling "lock her up," talking about the woman who accused Justice Kavanaugh of sexual assault many years ago. The court's legitimacy has taken a very serious hit. This is not something to worry about for the future. The future is now, and the question is going forward, how can the court rebuild or reshape its place in the national dialogue? I don't think it can ever go back to the prestigious place it occupied until recently. I think we are in unknown territory.
Well, one case that often comes up as a kind of watershed moment in the court's legitimacy is Bush v. Gore. Right? Here's Justice Breyer speaking in 2014 on the decision the Supreme Court made in that case, which many say determined the outcome of an election.
Well, I was in the dissent.
Yes.
I thought it was wrong. What I think is so remarkable about the country is that people thought it was wrong, about half the country probably. Mm-hmm. Others might have thought the opposite, but everybody followed it.
Rosanna, is that all that legitimacy requires? They rule, we follow the rulings? Is that enough?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot more there. They rule and we follow the rulings because of, as I said, this idea of buy-in and a perception that the institutions endure and sort of trump the day-to-day or year-to-year wins of partisanship. I do think that's an incredibly important example that the court ruled in Bush v. Gore, and Gore stepped aside, and Gore's voters acquiesced, but not without a lot of rancor. And that rancor, I think, it kind of simmers and bursts on the scene now and then. One of the things I think is so important right now is that this confirmation battle, and I hate to even use that word, but that's what it was, this confirmation battle took place in the backdrop of this midterm elections, and everything was in relation to how was it going to play for the elections. That's exactly how it should not happen. They could have withdrawn him when the temperature changed, as they did with other nominees in the past. We think of Judge Ginsburg or some of the others who fell for much less complex reasons. But they didn't because of the impact that they thought each party thought it would have on these midterms. And I think that's really a very negative thing for the institution of the court. Hmm.
Listen, as a reminder, we want to hear from you. You want to talk about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court? You think this is all being overblown? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. And let's take a first call from Paul in Sutton, Mass. Paul, how are you?
Yes. Hi, good. No, I don't think this is being overblown at all. I'm an independent, but I clearly heard, the candidate that was, that was elected indicating, drawing a comparison between, the pressures he was seeing with the Clintons and then saying, well, what's coming around is going to go around, meaning basically, just wait and see what's going to come, because I'm the conservative, and you're all going to see what's coming.
Yeah, no, thanks, Paul. I mean, that's exactly how partisanship spirals. One side sees the other take a step that they deem a step too far, and they respond by matching or overmatching with their own step, and you end up with this problem. And it's not going to get easier because the rulings are going to get... The rulings that are potentially coming are contentious, right? Not just on abortion rights. But Garrett, there's also this question about the executive agencies. That is, will this court allow the federal government to do its job regulating the environment, regulating the financial industry, and basically implementing standard regulations?
I think the only question there is whether they're going to cut back on this regulatory power slowly. It's going to be a death of a thousand cuts or all at once. But the conservative legal movement has been hostile to these regulatory agencies really since its inception in the 80s. And now they have justices who have expressed some hostility to it. They have a majority of them. And the question is, do they move incrementally, giving the Congress a chance to adjust, giving the economy a chance to adjust, or are they going to enact some fairly radical separation of powers doctrines that call what they call the entire administrative state into question? And that's something that bears very close watching and is often hard for, ordinary people to follow, because it'll be, the Merit Systems Protection Board or the peekaboo and so forth. But these rulings are really quite important.
And it could mean, I mean, the way I think about it is you could end up with a kind of partisan divide where what you have is liberal legislation that is trying to advance sort of progressive goals and a conservative court saying, actually, the government does not have the authority to implement these. So you end up in a kind of battle like that. Roseanne, is that a concern that you see that courts, a conservative court standing in the way of liberal legislative priorities and therefore increasing the partisan divide?
Certainly that's a possibility. I mean, the other thing that's new here in terms of, how are we evolved in terms of questions of legitimacy is that the speech that the new justice gave at the confirmation hearing last week, in which he was explicit about, revenge of the Clintons, unhappy with the election results, gave some litigants fodder to explicitly call him out as a judge, as a sitting judge, to say, you, having said these things, are not capable of being impartial when these and other issues are presented to you. And I think that is something new and dangerous in a different way, that the court is going to be continually called out and asked to demonstrate its impartiality in a way that we want to be a given.
So I think we have footage from that. So let's play a clip of Kavanaugh at the confirmation hearings.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
So this speaks to what you were saying, Rosanna, which is he raises the political stakes himself by invoking political differences.
That's right, explicitly, literally. That just if you pull a few phrases out, revenge of the Clintons, you know, left-wing groups. Justices try to avoid terms like that at all costs. And he's a sitting judge even while he's saying that. So for litigants to think that they're going to go in and get a fair hearing, I think that, you know, there's a good reason for them to be skeptical about that. And when you call that out, that's when you start to really erode the fundamental legitimacy of the institution.
Well, apparently not everyone agrees. Let's go to David from Natick. He's got an opinion on this. David, how you doing?
Great. Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the perceived legitimacy concerns. I personally don't believe that there should be any legitimacy concerns of the Supreme Court. And the reason I feel that way is because Judge Kavanaugh has been a sitting judge at a very high level in government for a very long time, and there have never been any concerns about his impartiality as a judge. And just a comment about the statement that Judge Kavanaugh made during the confirmation hearing, I believe that it's very difficult to separate personal and professional feelings. And I think when somebody attacks him personally and does what they did to his family, I think he's going to respond one way. I truly hope and believe that he will respond a very different way when he's sitting justice.
Thank you, David. I mean, David raises a good point, which is when the nomination was announced, legal scholars from really across the spectrum came out to say he's a respected person in the legal field, he's qualified, he's competent. That is, sort of the politics was hidden behind these claims about competence and have been for a long time. So I think there is now this argument that maybe it's actually a good thing that Kavanaugh has come out and been directly political. It strips the veil away from a court that has long been political. And Garrett, I'll ask for your sense. Is there a sense where actually this is just exposing the politics that's always been there, and maybe that's not such a bad thing?
You know, I'm sitting here trying to be a good sport and to find the silver lining in this, and I ain't got it.
I tried.
Yes, no, I appreciate it. But, you know, I think what Kavanaugh did in that speech, he crossed a line that Clarence Thomas never crossed. He pulled back a mask. If that's a mask, if that's the way all the justices are, then the Supreme Court has no legitimacy. And I think, you know, to show the degree of to which he crossed the line, you just have to consider that Justice John Paul Stevens, 98 years old, a man who has seen, you know, maybe almost a quarter of the Supreme Court's history, said, you know, shortly before the vote that he did not believe that anyone who was capable of making that statement ought to be on the Supreme Court. I was stunned when I saw that. You know, it's one thing for me to say that he shouldn't have done it. John Paul Stevens, a lifelong Republican, to say that a specific nominee did not belong on the court, we are in uncharted waters. You know, Justice Kavanaugh is no longer the well-respected judge he was before that speech. He is now the person who said those things, and he is going to have to deal with that legacy.
Rosanna, you see a silver lining here?
I'm not seeing the silver lining either. I'm trying really hard. I mean,
I'm selling this, but nobody's buying.
You know, one of the things that we've learned since, you know, high school civics is that we have two branches that are explicitly political. We vote for them. We campaign. But then we have this third branch that's different and special. And if we get to a place, as we really are right now, where the law is what five justices say it is, and it just depends which five justices those are, then I think we're in a very dangerous place in terms of our perception of and the reality of the rule of law, that there is this buy-in of our citizenry, that there really are principles out there that are discernible and true and not just a head count each time the issue comes up.
So what is to be done then? Garrett, packing the court, term-limited appointments, endless investigations, what should people be thinking about?
Well, you know, I think that it's a little early to start about packing the court. If I live right down the street from Congress. Last time I saw, there was a bunch of Republicans there and not enough Democrats, you know, to pack a phone booth. It's probably early to think about that. But I do think that the dialogue that is now taking place, which began at a low level after Bush versus Gore, but is now picking up speed, about, you know, what is the role we want a court to play in our democracy? How did this happen? You know, it's not at all clear that the framers of the Constitution anticipated that the Supreme Court would be this kind of arbiter of constitutionality. Maybe we want to consider the jurisdiction of the court. Maybe we want to consider that justices should be active justices for 18 years and then remain justices but no longer sit on cases after that in order to ensure turnover on the court. That's a good discussion. I would hate to have it framed purely in partisan terms of when, you know, you watch, when we get a majority, we're going to investigate the living daylights out of you. That I don't like to hear, and I don't think it serves anybody well.
It may not serve anybody well. It may happen anyway. That is, if the Democrats take the House, they will have the power to continue investigating Kavanaugh's past. In fact, let's go to a caller. Mike from Framingham has something to say on the subject. Mike, how you doing?
Hi, I'm doing just great. Doing
glad
just
to hear great. It.
Other than my head wants to explode after this nominee was nominated. It's just an incredible injustice. Any other candidate would have been gone after his behavior, just his behavior alone, never mind the numerous lies that he said. And for a Supreme Court justice to lie so consistently, it just boggles my mind. But there was one part of it that I believe the Democrats dropped the ball on. Mr. Whitehouse, Senator Whitehouse, asked him Devil's Triangle. And Kavanaugh hesitated and said, drinking game. And they moved right on. Now, if Mr. Whitehouse would have said to him, explain how you win Devil's Triangle and how you lose Devil's Triangle. How do you win that? How do you lose that? Because all games, there's a winner and a loser, and in drinking, you know, you can look at it. Do I have to take the drink or don't I have
to? No, Mike, this makes good sense. And I mean, I'm going to ask Rosanna about this. What happened? Had they pushed harder? Are they going to continue pushing? Do you see?
I mean, this is the comment that so many people make, that the Democrats, you know, come to a knife fight with a dill pickle, you know, and they don't really know how to fight back in the trenches in that way. And there were certainly opportunities to get a more rigorous cross examination there and reveal plainly to the listening public the degree of deception that the justice. Now justice was engaging in, but they just didn't have the stomach for it. And in addition, I think that format of these 5-minute quickie questions was never going to really give anyone the kind of traction that your caller would have liked to see. Going forward, you know, the question is, do the Democrats just wait it out and get their turn? And when they get their turn, they pack on their justices. I think that there's definitely an appetite for something a little bit more brutal than that, that, as you suggested, a reopening of these investigations if and when the Democrats have the House, a continuing exploration of whether there are other accusations or of the testimony of the justice himself. On the other hand, no one wants to see that. No one wants to see someone saying a sitting justice is going to be interrogated about perjury. So it's a no-win.
That's Rosanna Cavallaro. She's a professor of law at Suffolk University. Thanks, Rosanna.
Thank you.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Garrett Epps. He is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Thanks so much, Garrett.
Enjoyed it.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. With midterm elections less than a month away, candidates across the country are pushing hard towards the finish line, but newly released campaign spending data suggests there's at least one candidate here in Massachusetts who may be looking beyond 2018, Senator Elizabeth Warren. In the last 2 weeks alone, Warren has run more than 400 digital ads on Facebook, seen by millions across the country. And so far in 2018, she's the third highest political spender, trailing only President Trump and Beto O'Rourke, who's running an unexpectedly competitive race against Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Set this spending pattern alongside Warren's comment last month that she will take a hard look, that was quote, take a hard look, at running for president, and it seems like she may well be gearing up for a spot in the 2020 scuffle. Republican State Representative Jeff Deal, who's challenging Warren for her Senate seat, says it's unfair to Massachusetts for Warren to be running for re-election while also eyeing a potential presidential run, and he's called on her to drop out of the race. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks recently spoke with Deal and started by asking the state representative to clarify why he believes Warren should drop out.
If she gets elected and then starts running for president, that's at least one or two more years of nobody working down in Washington to have a seat at the table at a time when we need a voice in Washington to help us in Massachusetts.
Plenty of senators run for president during their terms. In 2016, five sitting senators, including Lindsey Graham, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Bernie Sanders all ran for president. John McCain ran for president when he was a senator. What about Senator John F. Kennedy? He ran for president when he was a senator.
That's not the same argument as when you're running for that seat. You know, if you've become the senator and you have a list of accomplishments you can point to, great. But for her, she's actually telegraphing that she wants to run for the presidency while she's still trying to run for a current seat.
All right, well, let me talk about some specific issues. Senator Warren made some strong comments on CNBC about the need for Congress to take up what she called sensible reform on gun laws. So here's a bit of what she said.
It is our responsibility here in the United States Congress to make sensible changes on behalf of the American people, not simply to be held hostage by the NRA.
And she went on to list a couple of possible reforms, including expanding background checks, limiting weapon capacity. Universal background checks is something the public has continually shown broad support for across party lines. Are there any gun law reforms that you would consider?
There's a bill that passed the House recently. It's called National Reciprocity. What it would do is allow lawful gun owners who have a license here in Massachusetts and other states where they license gun owners to have reciprocity, meaning that could be used in any other state, much
right.
like your driver's license.
Right. So if you have a gun permit from Texas, you could carry legally in Massachusetts.
Correct.
For example.
I think.
Doesn't that kind of trample on state rights? I mean, it's an interesting case for Republicans to make because Massachusetts wants this set of laws, and you're basically saying, no, we're going to trample all over those.
Well, I'm not saying trample. I'm saying Massachusetts has laws that work in this state. We haven't had Sandy Hook. We haven't had the massacre down in Florida because I think we have gun laws that even gun owners in Massachusetts agree is good. We don't have a gun show loophole. We have.
But wouldn't reciprocity be a problem for Massachusetts laws because it would essentially negate them?
Not if you're negotiating properly to make sure that our standards become part of the national standards. And I think that's part of the discussion I can bring to the table in Washington.
Let me stick with gun laws. I want to ask you about a bunch of independent studies that suggest that states with the toughest gun laws have the lowest levels of gun violence. Connecticut, Massachusetts are among them. In fact, countries with strong gun laws have much lower levels of gun violence than the U.S. with relatively permissive gun laws and has some of the highest rates of gun violence in the developed world. Does that suggest that stronger gun control works and that as a U.S. senator, you would support it?
Well, first of all, we're ignoring the example of Chicago where they have some of the most stringent gun laws and yet some of the most rampant, you know, abuse of gun violence out there. And yet the other thing is you look at other countries where guns are restricted. You have, unfortunately, a rising use of knives in Britain. I'm not saying, by the way, that we would need to ban knives. I'm just saying that, unfortunately, people are going to find a way to use violence in some different form or fashion, whether it's a pressure cooker at a marathon. You know, people are going to do violence if they intend to, with a car, potentially. Mm. But in this case, it's a constitutional right to bear arms, to have a gun for protection of your home. And I think, again, we have laws in Massachusetts that are working, and I think it's a good model for the rest of the country.
All right. So you've just received an endorsement from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, and they made reference to Elizabeth Warren's comments in August that the criminal justice system is racist, front to back. So here she is explaining what she meant by that.
There have been studies showing that exactly the same crimes committed by blacks and whites, that blacks are more likely to be arrested and blacks are more likely to be prosecuted.
So she's talking there about institutional racism, which is very different than saying cops are racist. Does she make a good point there?
You know, we took up legislation just at the end of this session that did criminal justice reform to decriminalize certain areas of possession and use. We also have in Massachusetts done a great job of creating drug courts, even veteran courts, to try to do diversionary practices mm-hmm. to keep people from being incarcerated. But I think when you say that the entire system is racist front to back, you're blanket indicting everybody, whether it's a law enforcement officer or a corrections officer or a court officer. Even, I think, in my opinion, the legislators who actually make the law. You're in blanket indicting them all as having a motive that is based on racism. I think we're trying to talk about the rule of law, which is trying to keep crime down, no matter who's committing it, whatever age, race, sex, or whatever. It's not trying to target any one individual race, in my opinion. It's trying to keep our communities safe.
Well, so again, though, let me come back to this idea. Let's just for the sake of argument here, what she was trying to say was that, I mean, that's what
she
said.
To be honest with you,
let me just finish, and then you can totally push back. Blacks are more likely to be arrested, and blacks are more likely to be prosecuted than whites for essentially committing the same crimes. So she's talking about a systemic problem. Is that not an issue that's worthy of consideration?
It may be an issue, but the way that the senator handled it, and by again making a blanket statement that indicts everybody, mm-hmm. does not add to the productive nature of discussion and how to fix things. When Republicans were working on health care reform over a year ago, she said that Republicans want blood money from the American people. That's the kind of rhetoric that really gets people upset about Republicans, and it's not supposed to be a partisan thing. No Republican runs for office trying to take away health care for people. What they're trying to do is make the system work better for people. And for her, it seems that that's her stock in trade, trying to accuse people of things in order to make herself look like she's the solution. But really, we don't see solutions, just anger being generated.
So Democrats would probably say that Donald Trump has much to do with the political tenor that we're hearing right now in Washington. So let me ask you a question about Trump. You co-chaired his presidential campaign in Massachusetts. You are considered to be the most pro-Trump candidate in the nomination race, which you won. So this is a state that voted 2-1 against President Trump. Doesn't that present a huge challenge for you in this race for the Senate?
Well, to put some context into it, Donald Trump did not contest this state with any real campaign. He also got 20,000 Democrats unenrolled in 2016 to pull a Republican primary ticket when he was running. So I think that there was a shift to seeing a candidate who was actually saying things that no other politician was saying. And yes, I agree that with his tweets and some of the comments he makes, it's difficult to be in support of everything he does. But and I'm not in support of every single thing.
So you take issue with his tone, let's say, in some cases. Anyway.
Sure.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this president has done what I feel he promised to do during the campaign, which is reduce international tensions. We now see North Korea a year ago threatening our allies with nuclear weapons, now potentially planning to have an Olympics themselves with the South Korea. We also see in the United States the economy turning around, the gross domestic product up around 4.1%, potentially towards 5%, the stock market hitting all-time highs. Economically, things are going extremely well. He's delivering on those promises, and that's why I supported him in the first place.
What do you say to concern that too much of these economic benefits are only helping the very wealthy? And I'll just cite one study. So the organization Just Capital did an analysis and estimates that about 6% of the money that corporations received as a result of the tax cuts went to workers through pay raises, bonuses, that kind of thing. Respond to this general idea that these economic benefits are largely accruing to the very, very wealthy and contributing to this expanding problem of economic inequality.
I think it's a narrative that tries to continue to push class warfare. I think my wife and I own a small business. Most business owners, most corporations are run by people who actually pay their employees first and then pay themselves afterwards, small business owners. People are seeing wage increases. They're very happy right now, and you're starting to see consumer confidence rise because of that. And I think that shows that people are getting the wage increases and the new jobs being created is really helping our economy and giving us a chance to be more competitive, not just in Massachusetts, but also with other states and internationally.
Let me ask you about one more issue, and then we'll wrap up. But I want to ask you about immigration and family separation at the border. I know you're for border security, that you support the president's approach on this. Did the Trump administration go too far here?
That was actually policy in place under the Obama administration that, thankfully, when it was brought to the attention of the Trump administration, they ceased that, have kept families together. And my opinion is that a solution like what Ted Cruz did, which was say, let's get more judges to the border so we can process people more quickly and keep these families together, I think that was a great solution. But in my opinion, a secure border eliminates the temptation for families to potentially take this risky effort to come into our country illegally.
But we all saw images of families being torn apart, kids in cages. I mean, do you have any issues with the way the White House is going about this?
Look, I've talked to Border Patrol agents. I have talked to Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. They all feel that the president's efforts to try to actually address secure border is the right way to go. I mean, there has been fence authorization in the past with Republicans and Democrats both supporting that. There was miles and miles of fence built in Texas and California and Arizona. The fact of the matter is it's just not a complete border and a fully secure border. I think all he's trying to do is make sure that we take immigration law as seriously as possible. If anybody wants to become a citizen of the United States, let's bring them in, but let's have it done legally.
Jeff Deal, last question, and this gets back to some of this rhetoric that we're hearing in this current political moment. The president has said on more than one occasion that the media is the enemy of the people. Do you agree with that?
I would not say the media is the enemy. I unfortunately feel like the media has become almost as divided in some ways on one side or the other, and I think that is a problem. I really hate the fact that people go on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and feel that they can attack even their neighbors right now. And unfortunately, we feel like it's a more divided country than it's ever been. And I certainly want to do what I can down in Washington to reduce those tensions, focus on the state of Massachusetts, what's good about it, what can be great about it for the future.
But isn't it important to speak out and call the president out when he makes statements like that? I mean, because that comes from the Stalinist world. The media is the enemy of the people. I've been at those Trump rallies where he's gotten the whole audience to turn around and sort of jeer at us. I'm not saying feel sorry for me. I'm just saying it's a scary thing when the leader of the free world does that.
Well, I mean, first of all, we have free speech, and of course that allows for the media. But at the same time, I think free speech also means you can question the media. And for a long time, it's felt like certain aspects of the media are focused on attacking one party. And I'm not trying to say it's about party, but unfortunately, it does seem like that can be the case sometimes. And I think what the president was doing was actually just letting people know, hey, there is a problem. And I feel like the media is part of it.
All right. Well, Jeff Deal, Massachusetts State Representative for the 7th Plymouth District, and he is the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. Jeff, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Great time, Anthony. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. It's become a new kind of tradition. Today's the day we argue about whether to celebrate Columbus Day or follow cities like Somerville and Cambridge who've rechristened it Indigenous Peoples Day. But we can also use it as an occasion to better understand the rich, complex world that Columbus stumbled upon in 1492 and the sometimes serendipitous, sometimes devastating chain of events that followed this clash of civilizations. Joining me now is a writer who has looked carefully at both sides of this world-changing event with two books aptly named 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, and 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Charles C. Mann, welcome to Radio Boston.
A pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. I mean, you wrote this book, the first one, 1491, this phenomenon of a book, later a miniseries, about the sophistication of the pre-Columbus encounter world. Just start by giving us a sense of what the Americas looked like in 1491.
Well, say that you were somehow in an airplane flying over the Americas at that time. You might start here and you'd see these sort of coalitions of villages sort of gathering together into sort of tiny empires all over New England. And then if you went further south, you'd see the remains of Mississippian villages and cities centered around these large earthen pyramids. Further south than that, you'd have the Aztec empires, it's called the Tarascans, these sort of much more larger centralized states, going to all the way to the west coast of South America, where you have the Inca Empire, Tahuantinsuyo, as it was called by them, which was the largest centrally organized state in the world at that time, had the largest road system, enormous thing that stretched equivalent from Stockholm to Cairo. And then in the Amazon, you, as we're just now finding out, you have these kind of ring cities, these sort of coalitions of cities that we don't know very much about, but we're learning a lot more now. So it was a thriving, bustling place full of millions of people doing interesting things.
So, yeah, there's two key questions, I guess, about these civilizations. One, the size. The other, how advanced they were. I think we'll start with the latter one. I mean, how advanced were these cultures of the Americas? What kinds of technologies? What kinds of norms of, you know, I don't know, city management?
Well, they're very different from their European counterparts. And so when you talk about how advanced they are, it depends what the yardstick is. For instance, no question that Europeans were much better at, you know, sort of machinery like pumps and that sort of thing, and the use of steel. On the other hand, I think you could make a pretty strong argument that many of the native societies of the Americas had much more sophisticated agriculture than what Europe did. There's no evidence of the kinds of frequent and recurring famines that were sort of the European stock and trade in the 15th century. And so that kind of land management, much more sophisticated. They also had sophisticated metallurgy, particularly in Mesoamerica and the Incas, but it was to use metals in ways that were completely different. You had these, they valued them for their ductility, for their bendability rather than their strength. And so you had these very elaborate metallurgical techniques to make metal shiny and that sort of thing, which are just as scientific and just as technological, but for completely different purposes. And I think that would be the way to understand them, as societies that thought about different kinds of technology in different kinds of ways.
And so then the next question, how big? How many people? I mean,
well, this is one of those historical debates, right? And the real answer is nobody really knows. The typical estimates are between 40 and 60 million in the Americas at the time of Columbus.
40 and 60
very roughly,
million.
Yeah, which is very roughly equivalent to the population of Europe at that time. I should note that these estimates of native population keep rising. And as a personal guess, I wouldn't be surprised if it shook out around 80 million in the Americas at the time of Columbus.
I know some scholars have pushed back against your book, suggesting the number, you know, you kind of reach for some of the higher numbers. Let's, if you were at a conservative number, like what's the lower bound in your mind of how few it could be?
Well, as I said, the typical scholarly estimates are on the order of 40 to 60 million. So perhaps 40 is a kind of a lower bound, 60 being an upper bound. And that is, I'm just noting that the historical pattern that, you know, if you'd gone 20 years ago, you would have had a different range and would have been lower. And so the numbers keep, you know, creeping up.
So, I mean, 40 million people, that's not sparse, especially if they collect themselves into cities and towns and empires. Yeah?
Yeah, some of the Americas were very densely populated. Mesoamerica, which is, you know, sort of Mexico and Central America, you know, the central part of that around what was now Mexico City was some of the most densely populated terrain on Earth. And similarly, we've recently found through these sort of LIDAR examinations of the Maya societies in the Yucatan Peninsula and further south that they were just also incredibly densely populated, that there was a kind of giant megalopolis over that whole area, you know, in about 800 AD.
So you mentioned
this.
So
you are talking about.
No, finish your thought.
You know, big societies, big scale societies.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned this LIDAR technology, which is amazing. So, right, the team of researchers with a Guatemalan nonprofit, Pecanum, they discovered, so that they fly in a plane and, you know, they use sort of lasers and try to map out lost buildings, structures, right?
What's under the tropical canopy, because there's a forest there now.
Right. So, and what they found was like a series of highways connecting cities, complex infrastructure for large agricultural projects. I mean, we have some here, for instance, here's Francisco Estrada Belli. He's the project's co-director, and he talked to CBS this morning about the discovery.
Part of the jungle we thought were empty are full of cities and small towns and amazing things that we didn't suspect were there.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a new discovery, but it dovetails in some ways with what you've been saying about the pre-Columbian Americas.
And it's not just me. I'm a reporter. I'm talking about archaeologists. And basically everywhere that they've looked, they found more than had previously been thought. And you can do this in a small way yourself. If you go to, you know, the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and go to any of the ruins, you'll see that there's an area that's been, you know, reconstructed and it has grass and so forth. And if you just go over the edge of the park and walk in the forest, as I did a few times with archaeologists, you can just walk for miles and you're walking over people's houses. So they knew already that the that the cities that we sort of see in these parks, you know, Chichen Itza and so forth, are just a fraction of what's out there. And what the LIDAR people tried to do is to take this knowledge and make it systematic. And they found that in the area that they looked at, which is a couple thousand square kilometers, they found evidence of 9 to 11 million people. And that's just a part of the central Mayan homeland.
Okay, so then Columbus arrives. Tell me a little bit about this man, Columbus, the man, the myth, the legend.
Well, he's born roughly 1450 in Genoa from a middle-class background that he was intensely ashamed of for his entire life. He leaves, by his own account, to go sailing when he's about 10 years old. And we have no evidence that he ever went back to Genoa. He ends up seeing actually quite a bit. He's in England. He may have been in Iceland. He sails off the coast of West Africa. He's around. He marries a pretty wealthy woman in Portugal, lives there, and gets somehow possessed of the idea that you should be able to sail west and encounter China and Japan. And he brings this, and that he should do it. And he brings this idea to the Portuguese court, and they quite rightly laugh at him.
Well, it's a crazy idea, right? They knew how big the globe was. They knew he couldn't sail that far.
Right. They knew that what he was proposing to do is, if you think about it, sail across the entire Atlantic, then what we now know as the American landmass, and the entire Pacific. And they knew how long that was, and they knew that 16th century ships simply couldn't carry enough supplies and water to make it that far. It would be a little bit like, you know, if you have a child and they came to you and said, I'm going to take my Volkswagen Bug and drive across the entire United States on one tank of gas. You would say, what?
But he doesn't care.
It's just not going to work.
He finds the financing. But he does it. And he sets off this incredible chain of events.
Yeah, he goes to Spain and they turn him down for the same reasons, because it's crazy. But he has this sort of messianic sense that he's acquiring of himself as a world historical figure. And he's kind of a nut. And what he has in his head, and he talks about this more and more as he gets older, is the idea he's going to make this great discovery. He's going to bring this huge amount of wealth to Spain. And the king and queen of Spain are then going to launch a new crusade, seize Jerusalem, and create a new heaven on earth. And it's all going to be because of him.
Well, in some ways, his acts do turn out to be pretty dramatic, if not messianic. I mean, he unleashes a set of historical changes virtually unparalleled, some of them devastating for the people who were living in the Americas, others of them enriching, particularly the agriculture of the rest of the world. How do you see this sort of chain of events following his quote-unquote discovery?
Well, if you think about it, you know, the Americas, you know, our hemisphere, and the hemisphere of Europe and Asia and Africa have been separate for tens of millions of years with, you know, almost no communication between them. And what Columbus does is he brings these two hemispheres, these two halves of the earth together, and he creates an ecological, social, political, economic explosion that, you know, rockets through the ages and that we're still living in the echoes of. So it's a huge event in the history of the world. So in that case, you're absolutely right. He was destined to be a world historical figure. It's just not the one that he thought he was.
And I mean, just to spell it out, the impact on the Americas we think about in terms of disease and devastation, yeah? And the impact back in Europe, you think about it, kind of very interesting text, about potatoes, tomatoes, beans, chili peppers.
Right. All these foods. Now, Europe can barely feed itself. You know, they have these recurrent waves of famine. There's a great French historian, Fernand Braudel, who sort of counted them up. And he calculated in a couple centuries before Columbus, there was a continent-wide famine. I think it was on the average of every 11 years. And you're talking about major deprivation. So that there is, you know, real problems in Europe. It was a poor, desperate place. And these bringing potatoes in there for Northern Europe, basically because potatoes are tubers and they can grow as big as they want to, whereas cereals like wheat are on thin stalks, potatoes are more productive. You get more calories per acre out of them. And, in the 18th century, you could get roughly four times as many calories per acre out of an acre of potatoes than you could out of an acre of wheat. And the result is, for the first time in history, Europe is able to feed itself. And this is what powers the later European empires. Meanwhile, the story is completely different in the Americas. Diseases that for historical reasons had never existed in the Americas arrive. And these are all the major killers, you know, smallpox, measles, influenza, you name them. And it's as if all the suffering and death that those diseases had created over the millennia in Europe and Asia and Africa happened in about 150 years in the Americas. And the consequences were catastrophic. It was the worst demographic disaster in the history of the human race.
Well, on that note, that's writer Charles C. Mann, author of 1491 and 1493. His most recent book is Wizard and the Prophet. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help today from Eve Zuckoff and Kainat Khan. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.